That's music for a Friday, if ever I heard it. It's Current State on WKAR. Our live music today, courtesy of Drew Howard on the dobro and acoustic guitar. Drew is a fixture on the Lansing and Michigan music scenes. We will be chatting with him later in the hour. Also coming up, we talk about the federal farm bill's impact on Michigan. It's also the weekend to sing in Lansing. And Melissa Benmark reports on the 10-Pound Fiddle's annual Midwinter Singing Festival. But first,
and let me be clear, we will keep right on pushing. Harder, faster, smarter. My foot will remain planted firmly on the gas pedal because Lansing cannot wait. Our time is now.
In his ninth annual State of the City address last night, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero said the capital city is unquestionably moving forward, but that the city needs to maintain momentum. The mayor focused on a series of recent successes and future initiatives, but he also drew attention to important challenges, including reforms at the Lansing Board of Water and Light, the city's questionable financial future, and the importance of accelerating regionalism. The speech was against the backdrop of General Motors' thriving Lansing Grand River plant. Our next guest was in attendance to respond. Current State welcomes back longtime Lansing City Council member Carol Wood. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Thank you. We've gotten class here with music and live music here and everything else. This is wonderful.
Friday's the day to be on Current State everybody is serenaded by some kind of music or another.
As long as I'm not asked to sing, we're okay.
We also need to mention that Aileen Bowles, the council's new president, is not well. She was scheduled to join us here on Current State. We hope to have Aileen on the program very soon. Carol, among all the things the mayor said last night, what stood out most to you?
Well, I think hearing about the budget for next year. You know, for the last several years, we've had to deal with deficit budgets and watch the economy and watch businesses close and houses foreclosed on, and understanding that at this current time, the mayor is projecting that we will have a balanced budget, that we won't have the deficit that we've had to deal with in the past, is very encouraging during this particular time of the year.
Now, I want to say this is the first time in 10 years, according to the mayor, that there hasn't been a deficit.
Correct. And again, you know, part of how the mayor has figured deficits in the past has been the fact is if we were doing business the same as we had done the year before, and we have a number of positions that have been cut over the years, so that's made a difference with services. We've also, again, made accommodations as far as the services that we do give out and made changes to those. So what we're looking at right now, from what I heard last night, is the fact that we won't start off trying to put this budget together with a deficit.
Okay, so that means no more cutting, but you won't be re-adding? Or do you anticipate, you don't anticipate the chance to re-add services or re-add personnel?
I don't believe so at this time. Not from what I was listening to last night. Things are getting better, but as he said, we do need to be watching the pocketbook, and that doesn't mean that we decide to start adding positions. Even as we look at the state, with $1 billion that they have in reserves there, we're not hearing that they're saying we're going to give more to revenue sharing to the city. Mm-hmm. If that happened, then maybe there would be another way to look at the budget. But at this point, I think what we're doing is looking at where we are currently and maintaining that.
Let's talk about the next budget document. What areas do you anticipate will be contentious?
Well, as always, we look at services and determine from the public what services they are willing to pay for and what they want to see from those services. And one of the ones that, you know, has been high in the public has to do with police and fire and roads. As we heard last night, you know, our roads that we've been dealing with are our third world roads out there right now, whether we're talking about the middle of winter or whether we're talking about the middle of summer. We are only in our budget able to put approximately $3 million a year into local streets. When I first came on council, we were putting $7 million in for 7 years. Over the years, because there's been less general fund revenue, we've put less into our local streets.
That was $7 million a year?
A year.
For 7 years.
Yes.
And we're now down to three.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. You know, and a lot of that has to do with things that we did as far as the CSO project, that's our combined sewer overflow. The loans and the things that we took out for those projects only allowed us to repave and do construction work where the trench was. What we decided as a community was that when we went in there, we were going to fix the road from curb to curb, which meant you were using your local dollars to finish up those projects. And so that meant there was less dollars used in on the neighborhood streets that needed to be repaired.
How much will $3 million get done?
On local streets, and it depends on whether we're talking patching or whether we're talking a complete resurfacing, it varies out there with that. We're doing some resurfacing on Jolly Road. In fact, it was a resolution that was passed last night from Dunkel to Collins, and we were looking at roughly around $1 million in that, and that's going to be remilled and resurfaced.
So there's a third of what you have, of the total you have to spend.
Correct.
The mayor emphasized in pretty stark terms that the city's IT infrastructure has to be addressed. Let's listen back to that.
Last year, I proposed a major new investment in our city's outdated IT infrastructure. Virtually everything the city does is underpinned by computer technology, and our antiquated systems are a catastrophic failure waiting to happen. They must be updated. I am calling upon my partners on the new city council to take up this matter immediately.
Carol Wood, are you as concerned as the mayor appears to be about IT infrastructure?
We do need to look at the IT infrastructure. It came up during the budget process, anywhere from police officers and dealing with the computers in their cars to firefighters that are using computers as they're entering data when they're at emergency services, to the fact that our tax returns and how those are dealt with. The concern I have is what council's been asked to is to approve a bond for $2 million. $1 million of that, that $2 million will be used for DuPont for services, and $1 million for new software and hardware. My concern is that if we're looking at paying an outside firm $1 million a year to help maintain our system, at the end of the year, what happens? Are we going to be budgeting again? It's different than buying a new computer, having that computer, and being able to utilize that for the next 4 or 5 years and knowing that you've got that versus the fact that you're paying for a service that next year will cost you another $1 million.
So would you prefer that all of that $2 million be assigned to software?
That was the understanding as we started the budget process, that that's what we would be doing, is using the $2 million to buy software, new hardware, and servers for our computer, not to pay for services. And so there will be a number of questions that we'll be asking through this process. Again, is to get a list of what products we're talking about. You know, what is it that $1 million will buy?
Did the mayor leave anything out of last night's address that you think he should have included?
Well, you know, with all budget messages, first of all, with all State of the City messages, what it is reinforcing the things that have happened in the past, looking at where we're going in the future, and setting that roadmap out there. The mayor talked about a number of positive things that he has initiated, as well as that are things that happened before he came to office. We look at GM and the fact that GM was retained in our area, and the fact that we have two state-of-the-art plants, and there are more buildings going to be added to the GM complex. That's extremely important for our region. We talk about the redevelopment and some of the things that are happening there. The NAPS building, along with Jackson National Life and the things that watching 1,000 new jobs come into that arena.
But did he omit anything that really should have been in there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
You know, I mean, again, you have a half hour to lay this roadmap out, and doesn't give you a lot of time. And I think that he hit the high points of the things that he wanted to hit during this.
We need to talk about the Board of Water and Light a little bit. There's been a lot of discussion of greater representation on the BWL Board of Commissioners to include communities outside of Lansing. The mayor said last night he's open to that. Are you open to that as well?
I'm willing to have that discussion. I think the thing that's really important for the public to understand is the residents of the city of Lansing own the Board of Water and Light. That's part of the charter. First and foremost, over the last 120 years that the board has been there, much of the infrastructure that was built were paid for by the ratepayers of the city of Lansing. That allowed us to give services outside the city. It's going to be important as we have this discussion exactly what this would mean and what the entities outside the city would be looking for.
But you are open to the discussion. For that discussion.
Yes. Yes, it is.
There have also been suggestions that the BWL should consider payments not just to the city, but to the other areas it serves. What do you make of that idea?
Well, again, the city has because it's a public entity, they do not pay taxes. And part of the pilot, the return that we receive on the gross revenues from the board is in lieu of those taxes. And again, the ratepayers and residents of the city of Lansing have helped build this company. So, I think it's something that is worthwhile to discuss. But also understanding that the reason that many of these entities, whether we're talking Delta, East Lansing, the reason that they have those the option to have Board of Water and Light is because the residents of Lansing helped build that facility.
It's the history of the
Correct.
Board of Water and Light that's really relevant here in your view.
Yes.
These changes would require amending the city charter. How much work would that be?
Well, it's like anything else. You can pull the section out that you're dealing with, and that would be the section on the Board of Water and Light, and it would be something that would be brought to a vote to the public.
We're led to believe that all, or just about all, community review team meetings will be open. Are you confident that'll be the case?
No. Did you like that short answer?
Yeah. Don't beat around the bush.
Yeah.
I mean,
my concern is that some of the statements that have been made by those that are in the leadership of this review committee, and the fact that they use words like burdensome to have discussions within the public to digest, to also look through this material, that some of it might be better to have these discussions in private. Again, this is a public utility, and in order to bring back the faith and trust that so many of us had over the years in the Board of Water and Light, this needs to be an open process.
As a longtime city official, though, Carol, you clearly understand the importance and the value of the occasional closed meeting. Why is that not appropriate for General McDaniel and his team?
Well, under the Open Meetings Act, we are limited to the times that we can have closed door meetings. Is it more convenient at times? Are there times that you might be more candid? There are those opportunities, but again, this is our utilities. I am a stakeholder in this as well as Mr. Smith down the street is. And to make sure, again, that people can feel the transparency of government, that they can feel that everything is happening the way it should. I'm sure Hillary Clinton, when she's stood before the Senate and talked about the things while she was Secretary of State, might have wanted some of that behind closed doors, but it wasn't. It was there for the public to see. It was there for everyone to err on the side of making sure that there was transparency and that the public understood what had happened.
Your successor as president of the City Council, Aileen Bowles, who again was scheduled to be with us here today but is not well, requested some seating changes at city council meetings that's become a dispute. How will this get settled?
Well, again, that is under the prerogative of the president of council. When I was president, I had a number of council members come to me and talk to me about the seating arrangement and the fact that they wanted to make sure that our internal auditor was sitting on the dais. And based on their concerns, I did move the mayor and place the internal auditor on the dais with us to be able to answer questions.
And that never came to a vote, which is a topic now,
yeah,
from the city attorney.
It never came to a vote, and the city attorney sat next to me for that entire year and never said to me that I don't believe that you have the authority to do that and that you need to bring this to the council. And again, Aileen did send out a seating chart and did ask for input from council members before this became public. To my knowledge, I don't believe she received any input other than from the city attorney. And her comment was, great, I really don't like being on camera anyways.
So it is within the president's authority to determine the seating.
I believe it is.
It doesn't need to come to a vote of the entire council.
I agree. It does not.
And it appears not to be explicitly addressed in the city charter?
No, it doesn't.
There was a lot of talk going into this last election about the desire for a more productive working environment among council members, as well as with the administration. This incident looks to some of the public like it's just going to be more of the same. What needs to happen in your view to ensure that the council's effective this year?
Well, you know, again, going back to the seating arrangements, I think there's been a lot blown up about it that didn't need to happen. You know, again, you mentioned that I made some changes when I was president, and we didn't have editorials on it. We haven't had all this other discussion. So I think, first of all, from the press perspective, let's put it to rest and let's move on to what is important. And part of that is looking at some of the things that we do have on our plate.
Okay.
BWL, I think, is extremely important that we have to work through that situation. Emergency management, to make sure that all of our plans from a city's perspective as well as the boards are in order, and working on some of the regionalism issues that we have out there and creating better partnerships.
Carol Wood is a longtime member of the Lansing City Council. We've been talking about Mayor Bernero's State of the City address last night and related topics. Carol, thank you.
Thank you.
Lansing guitarist Drew Howard on guitar. We'll be talking with Drew in a little bit, and we'll be hearing him perform throughout the rest of the program here today on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tonight is the first night of the 10 Pound Fiddles Midwinter Singing Festival, and Dr. Ize Barnwell will lead the first group sing tonight at the Hannah Community Center in East Lansing. She's a founding member of Sweet Honey and the Rock, as well as a composer, educator, and public health expert. Interestingly enough, in Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with Dr. Barnwell about tonight's event.
Yes, she was really amazing to talk to. And one thing I want to emphasize is that Pete Seeger died that day, as we were sometime around the time we were talking, or else it hadn't hit the presses yet. And I just wanted to mention that because there's no way that you can talk about group sings without talking about
Pete
Seeger.
That's right. How ironic.
And so that was one thing that I asked her a couple of times what she was planning on leading, what songs she was planning on leading in the group sing. And she wasn't quite sure yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if some Pete Seeger shows up in this particular festival.
I often will wait until I am with the group to see what the group's energy is and what's going on, and that will help me to decide. So I don't think I can tell you now.
Talk a little bit about the place of singing in the everyday lives of, I guess, specifically Americans, that there was a time when people, I think, sang together in the home a lot more and sang together in groups more. And it almost seems like it's sort of turned into a spectator sport.
Well, you know, in the old days, we didn't have iPods or any of that. So, you know, we had to share with other we had to share with other people. And I think that we did sing a lot together. Now, you know, I really focus a lot on African-American culture. And so when I think about, quote unquote, the old days or the past or where our music kind of began, you know, I understand really how profound an experience it was for communities to sing together. It was the way, singing was the way in which we commented, documented, preserved our history. And we did that by singing about what was going on now, so that we could remember today's now and yesterday's now and the nows before then, which actually are the sum total of our past. And so as African Americans, you know, in large part, our history of enslavement is recorded in song. And it was communal song. It wasn't music that was, quote unquote, composed by an individual and then sort of put on the group. No. The entire community participated in creating the music. And so it had to have been a communal experience. We still do that in church, as do many religions and cultures in this country. We sing communally. But I think that there is something that has happened across our American culture, which is that we begin to withdraw from the community and create a space for our individual selves. Things have changed a lot. Our technology fosters going into isolation with earbuds in our ears. And so we can listen to, you know, whatever we want to listen to in a crowd, even at the dining room table, even with members of our family. So the more we can create opportunities for people to come back together and to hear our individual voices blended with other voices, I think the healthier we become as individuals and as communities, because we're pulling our energies back together instead of siphoning them off.
You've been a violinist for pretty much all your life, it sounds like, and you're actually named for a very famous violinist. And yet you are noted primarily, at least in, you know, in your recording career, as a vocalist. Talk a little bit about the interaction between mastering an instrument and mastering your human physical voice, and how those two things play off of each other at times.
Wow. Well, that is a complex question. I am named after a violinist. His name was Eugene Ize, My father was a violinist. My father started teaching me violin at 2.5, and I studied until I finished high school. I majored in music in high school. And at that point, I actually stopped playing. And I haven't really played for about 40 years, but I picked it up several years ago when Sweet Honey was planning a project, and I was trying to think of interesting things that I could bring to that project, which was in tribute to Odetta, Nina Simone, Miriam Makeba. And so we recorded that project. It's called Tribute, and so people can hear me doing a duet between the violin and my voice. I have not ever actually studied singing. I sang in many choirs all through college and started a choir. I never intended to do music professionally. But, you know, sometimes the larger spirit knows more than we do. And somehow for the last 35, 36 years now, I've been doing music professionally, which is shocking to me. So I studied violin for a long time, gave it up, have sung for a long time, but not studied, started composing about 35 years ago. And really everything that I am doing now is really based on what I learned before I graduated from high school.
That's interesting. Everything I needed to learn, I learned in high school, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. In terms of the music, I mean, I had a really good, solid foundation, so I feel like I was well prepared, and I'm grateful for that. You know, there were those who knew more than I did and passed it on in wonderful ways.
So is there one song that you're absolutely certain will make it to the Friday night community sing?
No.
Then our listeners will just have to wait for it.
They will just have to wait. And don't expect that it will be quote-unquote Sweet Honey songs. That's not what I do. It'll be wonderful. It'll be big fun. It really will. But it helps me really to kind of locate myself, you know, to have a sense of how many people and who will be there, to have a sense of the hall, and all of that helps. And I have, you know, several hundred songs that float around in my head all the time, which is why I don't listen to other music, I guess. So there are lots of things that I have to choose from, but I can't tell you what I'm going to land on.
Dr. Izai Barnwell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Lansing guitarist Drew Howard today on Current State, playing for you live from Studio S at WKAR. We'll talk with Drew in just a few minutes about his music, and we'll be hearing more from him as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's 90.5 WKAR. It was 2 years overdue, but the 2013 Federal Farm Bill is making a steady course toward President Obama's desk. The House passed the bill on Wednesday. It now goes to the full Senate, which is expected to take action as early as today. The bill cuts spending by nearly $1 trillion over the next decade. It's a historic piece of legislation in that it eliminates direct annual subsidies to farmers, which have been a mainstay of the agriculture industry for decades. The bill also imposes a 1% cut on food stamps, which analysts say could worsen the plight of millions of Americans living in poverty. We have two guests joining us today to talk about the new farm bill. Alan Garner is the District 5 director for the Michigan Farm Bureau, and that district covers five mid-Michigan counties. Alan, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
And also with us by phone, Justin Rumenap, who is a spokesman with the Center for Civil Justice in Flint. Justin, welcome to Current State.
Glad to be here, Mark.
Alan, the centerpiece of this bill, as we said, is the elimination of direct subsidies to farmers. This has been in place since the 1920s, and it was designed to keep commodities prices stable. That's now being replaced with this expanded risk management system, a huge policy shift. Can you help us understand this change?
Sure. Well, Mark, prior to 1996, any financial assistance that production agriculture enjoyed was tied to our production on a bushel-per-bushel basis. And the United States belongs to the World Trade Organization, and they kind of monitor how various industries are supported by local and federal governments. And they determined that that could be trade-distorting. So in a way around that, in 1996, that farm bill did start, in fact, the direct payments that weren't tied to any sort of production requirements. It was just a check in the mail, if you will.
Mm.
And quite frankly, production agriculture was kind of uncomfortable with that. For obvious reasons, we found ourselves in the worst-case scenario that we anticipated the last few years, and in the sense that our industry was very profitable, and yet we were receiving these checks in our mailbox. So agriculture is very supportive of this new course, this new direction.
The people you represent are generally okay with this transition.
Absolutely. That's what we lobbied for, quite frankly.
Instead of subsidies, the bill strengthens crop insurance. This is the risk management part of the equation that's designed to help farmers share in the cost of disaster relief. What benefits will that bring to Michigan farmers?
Well, we need a safety net, even though we don't feel like we can be out there totally without some protection, because obviously production agriculture is pretty unique in the sense that we deal with the weather. So we can do everything quite perfectly in terms of marketing, use of the latest technology, and yet we still can find ourselves in a pretty miserable situation in terms of profitability from time to time. So this is a wonderful new plan in the sense that it's a public-private partnership. You know, we become responsible for premiums for our insurance policies, and we have an opportunity to determine how much risk we want to take by having the ability to take different levels of protection through those policies. And so I believe it makes us all much more engaged and more responsible.
So for the layperson, if I were to try to summarize what you're saying, would it be accurate to say that guaranteed annual payments are being cut in lieu of crop insurance when it is necessary? Is that it in a nutshell?
Guaranteed annual payments are not just being cut, they're being totally
eliminated.
Yes, I just wanted to be clear about that.
In lieu of the risk management.
Yes, and certainly we've had an opportunity to participate in crop insurance programs for a number of years now, but those products have been enhanced to the point that they make a lot more sense now, and they certainly provide the type of safety net that I believe the industry needs to have.
Justin Rumenap, let's talk with Justin here about the cuts to food stamps. These total about $8 billion over a decade, far below what House Republicans wanted to cut, which was about $40 billion. Is this a continuation of the cuts to food stamps we saw back in November, or is this on top of that?
This is on top of that. The cuts from November were cuts to pre-recession levels. There was a little bit of bump to the benefits to the SNAP program, which is better known as food stamps. SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The November cuts were about $11 per person per month for those who are on the SNAP benefits or the bridge card here in Michigan. These are in addition to that. So the Novembers were cutting it back to pre-recession levels. These are on top of that.
Mm. What concerns do you have for food stamp recipients in Michigan who will be getting less?
Yes, food stamp recipients in Michigan are going to be hit especially hard because it can be up to $90 per household, per month, depending on a variety of factors. And there's up to 651,000 households that could be affected by these changes, the decrease, the $8.6 billion you mentioned just a moment ago.
In recent years, Justin, what pattern have you seen, I beg your pardon, in terms of the need for this SNAP assistance? Has that been going up? Has it been stable? Has it been going down? What?
Here in Michigan, the need for food assistance has been pretty steady and unfortunately remains at fairly high levels. As we mentioned, there was already cuts in November on these additional cuts that are coming. As not only our families, you know, $90 a month is a week's worth of groceries for some families, but it's also they're turning to the food banks, local churches, food pantries, and those places are already strained as well. So Michigan is still struggling to come out of the economic recessions, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, and as we're still struggling to raise the employment rate in the state, the need is still pretty steady, unfortunately, for food assistance.
One concern is a change in the so-called Heat and Eat program. Michigan's one of 15 states that offers both heating and food assistance to low-income families as one package. How will this new measure affect Heat and Eat?
Yeah, that's where the $90 I mentioned for the 651,000 households that are eligible for the Heat and Eat could see up to the $90 per month change. Basically, how that works is under current rules, anytime you get the assistance for heating credits, you're automatically eligible for an increase in the food assistance. Under the new rules, I believe you have to get $20 or greater per month in the heating assistance to have additional SNAP funding or food stamp funding kick in. So that's the concern there is that might be too high, and I don't have exact numbers of households that will meet are above or below the 20, but there are 651,000 households that are getting, under current rules, the additional Heat and Eat credits.
Let's return to Alan Garner and talk a little bit about the changes in risk management as opposed to the direct payments. Alan, less than 2 years ago, Michigan fruit growers, apple growers in particular, as I recall, were just hammered by a premature hot spell in March, which ended up wiping out a lot of the crop. Was that incident factored into this legislation? How would the new arrangement impact fruit growers who are caught in those circumstances?
Well, prior to that emergency situation, actually, there were ongoing efforts to create new insurance products for fruit and vegetable growers. It's been an ongoing project, and there's been a lot of support from the government as well as private industry in those efforts. So in this farm bill, we're very fortunate to have had Senator Stabenow, of course, here from Michigan, to be the Senate Ag Chairperson. And she did an exemplary job in providing some additional assistance to make sure that those efforts would continue to be ongoing, that these folks would have better protection for their disaster concerns in the future.
But do any of those, the farmers who are especially vulnerable, I mean, as I imagine, Michigan fruit growers must feel with such a recent memory of a disaster, are they confident about this new bill in that they're covered?
I don't know that they are totally covered. Some of their products are. Some it's still an ongoing process to develop the appropriate insurance product so that it's actuarially sound and makes sense for the farmer. But I think they're very satisfied in the fact that a lot of attention is being given them. There's an understanding of their plight, and they're trying to get them on the same playing field as the major crops, as corn, soybeans, and wheat, in terms of the ability to protect themselves.
I realize you don't represent a whole lot of fruit growers, given where the part of the state that you represent, but it's a relevant question, it seems.
Absolutely.
To me. Back to Justin Rumenap, with regard to your role at the Center for Civil Justice in Flint, are you paying attention to the debate over raising the minimum wage here in Michigan and at the federal level?
That's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but we certainly have been keeping an eye on that. As I mentioned before, the unemployment rates and the food insecurity rates are not unrelated. But I'm not sure if there's a specific question you wanted to ask, if I'll be able to answer it.
Okay, well, it just crosses my mind that a number of the people that you work for would benefit from a raise in the minimum wage, that's all.
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe a raise in the minimum wage would help decrease the food insecurity rates in the state and nationwide.
Would it compensate, though, for the cuts in the SNAP program and food stamps?
I guess that would depend on the specific how high the minimum rate the rate would be. I'm not sure I have that data at this time. I guess it would just depend on how high the minimum wage would be raised.
How will the people you work for adjust to this change? How much of a transition will this be?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, a lot of them, for those of you who are seeing up to the $90 per month, that's a week for worth of groceries, are probably going to have to rely more on the food banks, the food bank networks, food pantries, and churches. And those, some of the other food advocates in the area I've spoken to are kind of worried about being able to meet that demand, because the demand has already kind of risen with the cuts we talked about a little earlier in November. So it's going to be a tough time. It's going to be a tough winter, and I'm hoping that the food pantries can help meet the need for that. We're also hoping that the Department of Human Services, once the new rules take effect, will perhaps be able to adjust their calculation of the food stamp rates to help mitigate some of the damage, some of the loss that some of these households might see.
Did the two-year delay hurt this two-year wait for another farm bill? Was there a price to pay there for the farmers you represent? Was there much impact just in the delay?
Well, it was mostly just simple frustration in terms of the inability of our government to function and create a new farm bill. They did extend the old farm bill, so
okay.
We continue to operate under those rules. But, you know, generally speaking, no matter how dysfunctional Congress is, they usually can come together on a farm bill, but that certainly wasn't the case this go-around.
Well, there is no other piece of federal legislation that is quite like the farm bill. That's what we've been talking about with our two guests. Alan Garner, District 5 Director of the Michigan Farm Bureau. Justin Rumenap, spokesman with the Center for Civil Justice in Flint. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lansing guitarist Drew Howard, live from WKAR's Studio S here, performing for you live. We've heard some dobro, we've heard some classic six-string, steel-string acoustic guitar, and we welcome Drew Howard here to Current State. You are sounding great today, Drew. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's such a the dobro in particular is such an eye-catcher just because, well, you don't see it too terribly often, but it's just there's an awful lot of metal that's a part of a dobro guitar, which I suppose accounts for its a pretty crispy sound.
It's got a big hubcap on it.
Yeah.
A really big aluminum
hubcap. And they're just cool. I mean, they just look cool. There's all that shine to it.
It has some chrome to it, kind of like an old American car. Maybe we could bring that chrome back, Mark. What do you say?
It's the 57 DeSoto of the guitar world is really what it is. But
time stands still in the guitar world. It really does.
There aren't a ton of dobro players. Is there any kind of fraternity amongst you guys?
Sure there are. There's Joe Wilson from Steppin' In It. He's up in Traverse City. There's Mark Lavengood, who plays with Lindsay Liu and the Flat Bellies. Those are two cats I can think of off the top of my head, there's Andres Beck with Green Sky Bluegrass from Kalamazoo. So there is a fraternity.
And a demand.
Sure, there's I'm working.
Yeah.
We're all working.
There's you play the dobro flat on your lap.
Correct.
How big an adjustment is that if you've just been a conventional guitar player for 20 years?
Well, it's a bit of an adjustment because you're using a bar in your left hand. You're not using your fingers. You're
exactly.
using a bar. So, and on your right hand, you're using picks, which may or may not be an adjustment. So it's, sure, it's an adjustment in lots of things, in repertoire and you know, what you're learning and what you're hearing. And like with any instrument, if you want to learn, you really need to get deep into the instrument, into the repertoire, and listen.
You've been a part, a fixture, really, of the local music scene here for quite a while. How has it evolved? How has it changed over the years?
That's a really good question. I mean, certainly the music that I've changed over the years has changed for me personally, but there's always been a great folk scene, certainly because of the presence of elderly instruments here in Lansing. That's a magnet for players, world-class players around the country and around the world to convene here. And it certainly... for me, means that I can go down the street and buy a Bill Monroe record or a Little Walter record, all in the same place, or buy a dobro. Which you can't, you know, everywhere in the country. So certainly, I've spent more than my fair share of dough at elderly, and gladly so.
See, I'm one of those scary guys who goes to elderly and doesn't spend enough money, but I probably should. I'm probably the bane of their existence. You're a music teacher as well.
Yes.
Do you find young people are interested in playing the dobro in particular?
No, this is a pretty specialized instrument.
Do they even know about the instrument?
It's not a... I get a lot of... What's that?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of in the obscure ranks of instruments up there with a commodophone or, you know, things like that, if you know what that is.
No, tell us.
Well, it's a commode with a guitar neck on it.
Okay.
Of course. Everybody knows that.
Do they sell those at elderly instruments?
They might.
They should think about it.
You could call and ask.
There's an attention getter in the musical instrument landscape.
Certainly.
Pete Seeger's been on the minds of a lot of us this week. We mentioned Pete Seeger earlier in the program. I have to ask you about him. What if any impact did he have on you as a musician?
Well, he's always been a presence. Even if I was playing music that was far removed from anything he ever did, he was one of the first singing voices I ever heard because of growing up in the 60s and my parents having records. And so his voice is just, you know, it's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not. But, I mean, obviously it still will be. And also he had a TV show in the 50s that he would bring folk musicians on, blues musicians, and you can see those clips on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so he was huge in bringing folk music and American music to the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one of the many things he did.
I almost always saw him with a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
Do you play the banjo as well?
Just a little bit, just enough to get me in trouble and also get me paid. So I play banjo with Heartland Klezmorum, which is a klezmer group, and also in Little Darlin's Vaudeville, which is I'm in the pit orchestra for that group.
Do you play any other? So that's three. We're up to three, basically three different kinds of stringed instruments. Do you play any others?
I play pedal steel guitar with country groups and singer-songwriters around the state in album sessions and all of these instruments in commercial sessions as well.
Now, for you've sounded great here this morning.
Thank
for people
you.
Who want to hear more of what you do, where are you going to be soon?
Saturday night, I'll be playing pedal steel guitar with a country band in Ferndale. Tuesday, I'll be playing guitar and lap steel with Peter Madcat Ruth in Monroe, Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
And those are two upcoming shows. Thursday, I'll be playing with Drew Nelson, lap steel, and Telecaster at the Gopherwood Concert Series at the Elks Club in Cadillac, Michigan.
Boy, you move around a lot. You get to play with a lot of different kinds of people.
I'm very fortunate. In this state of ours, we have fantastic, like I said, world-class musicians, and I know a lot of them, and happy for that.
Yeah, it sounds like an awful lot of fun. Sounds like you got a rich career here. Drew Howard, we want to thank you. Is Drew going to play us out as well? Okay. We're going to let Drew put down his dobro and take up his what appears to be a tack of mine.
It's a Larrivee.
A Larrivee.
That
okay.
I bought at Elderly. And, of course.
What's this called?
This is called a Larrivee acoustic guitar. It's built in Canada. I'm going to sing a song that I wrote.
I meant the song.
I'm going to sing a song that I wrote. It's called Waking Dream.
Drew Howard on Current State.
Thank you. I was walking with my friends and family, flying high above the fields and the streams. I was walking down the same old highway. I could hear the sounds of the people in the city. Don't disturb my waking dream. Don't disturb. I'll join with you directly by myself.
That's our show for today. We hope you have a great weekend. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Deep inside.